This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Jason Graves, and it's just so much fun to catch up. And oh my goodness, you have had such a busy year.
Well, busy is good, I always say. But, you know, sometimes when it keeps you unable to keep in touch with some of your friends, which I consider you one of, it does get a little frustrating. So I am glad that we can finally catch up after it's been, what, 9 months since GDC, since we last talked.
Yeah. And you gave me a quick little tutorial on plugins, which was super helpful. And and we've got some really, really cool things to talk about. Your soundtrack for Man of Medan, which is amazing and terrifying, and then the music that you wrote for DC's Swamp Thing, which is also incredible and terrifying. And so so a lot of media composers get asked, what's the difference between writing music for games and writing music for TV and film? And I think we've probably talked about that too, but I'm wondering, you know, what the similarities are between the two.
I love the way you put that, because everyone does always know what the difference is. You know, I think now more than ever, it's important, at least to me, to mention that I grew up and went to school as a film and television composer. That's what I wanted to do. There wasn't that big of a market for video game music, you know, back in the 1820s when I was in college. So I was really aiming for film and TV. And when I did sort of stumble into game music, like in 2000 or 2001, I was really approaching it more from a film or TV aspect, meaning, like, you know, lots of tension and resolution and dramatic shifts and things that would underscore the story, even if I was just told to write a 60-second piece of, you know, action music. I gave it a lot of push and pull and a lot of dynamics and a lot of drama, because that's the kind of music that I like to listen to. So that was sort of the common ground for me between the two. For me, you know, writing video game music, I wasn't thinking, okay, I need to write one level that's really quiet and one level that's a little louder and then another level and all these intricate sort of sophisticated dynamics and automatic gameplay systems and everything. I'm always more focused on the overall sort of aesthetic of the score, just like if I were scoring a TV show or a film, and the emotional impact more than anything else, which lately, as you said, has been terrifying. It's been a terrifying year, I guess.
I would love to start out by talking with you about Man of Medan, because you've created so much atmosphere for that game. And it's such an interesting story. It's kind of like a many-layered story. And there's a ship that sinks mysteriously during World War II. It's actually based on a real account that happened. There was a real ship with all the crew dying with horrified expressions on their faces. And so in the now times, this crew of pretty young people, they're all enthusiastic and they want to track this ship down. And so just that story must have given you a lot of ideas for what direction to take the music in.
Well, the beginning of any project for me is always, you know, what can I do that, of course, is going to service the game and make a compelling, you know, emotional bed for the gameplay or for the TV show or for the film, for the viewers or players when they're engaged in whatever it is that they're watching or playing. But honestly, the first thing I always think of is, what can I do that's different for me personally that will keep me interested, but also get me excited about learning some new things and trying out something, or especially trying out lots of things that I've never tried before, which is probably the main reason that so many of my scores are so different from each other in terms of instrumentation or style or tone. Not just because of the games, obviously Moss is going to have different music than Dead Space, but I just love the idea of almost boxing myself into the point of where I start to panic a little bit and I think I've made a mistake. Like, it seems usually about a third of the way through the project, if I've done my job right, which is almost all the time, I'm in a bit of a panic and I think I've really messed up here and this was a stupid idea and I'm not going to be able to finish, you know, what I kind of saw as the perfect way to reproduce this soundtrack. I'm going to have to go to my outliers and kind of step over the boundaries of what I considered accessible. But then the next day I come back and, you know, kind of go back. So with Man of Medan, Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I need you to answer me honestly about this. Does anything seem, I guess some of the adjectives I was going for here were like murky and deep, like underwater, you know, like the like tides and currents, ebb and flow. Does any of that sort of ring a bell when you listen to the soundtrack for Man of Medan?
Oh, absolutely. Especially the very first track that's kind of setting up the location and the, you know, getting into the story and all of that. And I let you know this week I was driving home and it was dark and really, really foggy. Yeah. And the music was absolutely perfect for the same reason, because, you know, when you're out at sea, there's no horizon. You just don't know really what's in front of you. And so, yeah, you really nailed that sound.
Well, that's really cool. That was a lot of, I mean, some stuff I think is super obvious. If you talk about film scores that I think of immediately, if you say ocean or underwater, Mysterious Island and 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea, like books like that, but the 13 Mile Reef, Bernard Herrmann stuff, you know, he used lots of harps and low woodwinds and things. You know, I'm a huge fan of all those low woodwinds. Even Sphere, Elliot Goldenthal did this amazing score for Sphere, which didn't really have anything to do with Man of Medan, but it was one of the first things that kind of popped into my head, because it is scary. It's underwater and it's scary. So the biggest thing I did that probably no one's going to listen to the score and pick up on this, and this is not why I do it. I don't do it as a subliminal thing for listeners to pick up on. I do things like this as a motivator for myself. Like I said, what have I not done before? Well, one of the things that I really don't like doing, don't ask me why, I don't like writing in three. Like in 3-4 or in 6-8 or 12-8, like with triplets, you know, da 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 da. I think when I last tried it, you know, 20 years ago, it just sounded like really lame pirate music. And I just stay away from it at all costs. So the first thing I decided to do for Man of Medan was everything, every single cue is in 3, the whole entire score.
Wow.
And if you go back and listen to it, it's all in 3. I mean, and even if it sounds like it's duples, like dun 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 dun, it's still like 1-2-3, 1-2-3, dun 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 dun. So that three to me kind of is like La Mer or something. I don't know. It's very cyclical in it. You can see, I love being able to video chat with you while we do this, by the way. You can see me doing my hands. So I'm moving them like in a wave, right? It's sort of like the ebb and flow of the tide. Something about 3-3-4 or 6-8 with triplets or something like that. Just sounds like the ocean, like the rhythm of the tide and the waves when you're in the boat and the rising and falling of, you know, the boat up and down. That all that just seemed to really work. So the whole thing is in three. That was kind of the, you know, it's not a big deal if I say it, but it was a big deal for me because every single cue, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, crap. Everything's got to be in three. But so I kind of broke the curse that I had given myself, you know, 15 years ago. Now I don't feel like I'm writing cheesy pirate music, hopefully, since it's in three.
Well, so how did you have to rethink the cues so that they would work in three? Like you get a little melody in your head and then do you have to just like change the rhythm of it or the meter so that it fits?
I'm very much, being a drummer, I'm usually thinking about tempo first and I'm thinking about meter first. So I'm automatically, like my brain is going, nope, stop it, you know, slapping myself on the wrist and go, got to be in three. You got to start, you know, maybe we're going to be in 6-8 or 3-4, one of the two. So I start with that and then I figure out kind of what key I want to be in depending on the register of the instruments. And then I start messing around with chords. And once I get some chords in play, that's when I start noodling with melody. So that first piece of Stormy Seas and Howling Winds was basically just like with Until Dawn. It was just the pitch that I sent to Supermassive. It was, this is the main theme and this is everything about the score. You know, you've got the low woodwinds and the crashing waves and the music and the 3-4 and the ebb and flow and the harp and all of Kristen Nagus's beautiful like bass and alto flute playing on there. That was kind of the whole thing. And just like last time, they were like, that's great, so write some more cues for us. They're wonderful to work with. I love those guys.
Wow. Well, what was their pitch to you to get all these ideas going? I mean, how did they like hook you on writing the music for the game?
Well, as usual, I started early, which is what I prefer to do. And what that means is I started before there was really any real gameplay. I mean, they could send me stuff that had, you know, the stick people with the temporary voiceovers. And it's almost better just to let the audio director or the creative director explain it rather than watching that horrible temp stuff at the beginning, because there's nothing inspirational about that. But I knew the story. And I knew the plot and I understood the characters. And I also knew, which I think is very important for these kind of games, the extent to which the game was going to be very, very granular in terms of all the choices that you could make. You know, it was even multiplayer. So you have multiplayer. So two different people can play and they're each making different choices. So it was even more bits and pieces for Barney Pratt is the audio director at Supermassive. So more bits and pieces for me to send to Barney and for him to ask for more of once I send a cue in than Until Dawn, which I think Until Dawn was probably, I mean, it was 22 or 25 stems of music for each piece. And this one, and we were getting up into almost 40 by the end.
Wow.
For each piece of music, just because there'd be, you know, I'd play a harp. I do live harp on this. So I'd play a harp line that would, you know, run the 2-minute length of the cue, doing whatever I thought worked, and he would pick out one section and go, this is so cool, we're using this all the time, can you give us like another take, even if you think it doesn't really fit with the whole song, just give us a whole 2 minutes of that kind of a, you know, maybe it was like a like little things that would come up and down. That's a really important thing to consider for all this interactive stuff, because they need to be able to chop it up and trigger it at certain times. So it was a lot of back and forth with Barney just in terms of the best way to get him what he needed to make that interactivity really, really work. Because they're going for basically this Dark Pictures kind of saga of games, is they're not as long as Until Dawn. So it's not maybe a 10 or 12 hour bit of gameplay, but it's about 4 times more deep in terms of the interactivity. So even though it's maybe a 3 or 4 hour game, really, you're looking at 16 or 20 hours of a viable replay, because you can go off on completely different tangents. Until Dawn was fairly linear, like with little branches here and there. You know, certain characters could die earlier, or certain could live. This is like a whole other thing. So the music had to do the same thing.
Wow. So how much music did you end up writing for all of this?
Well, so this is where it gets tricky, because we didn't even really understand how to figuratively talk about this. Because like I said, 40 tracks of music, or 40 stems, I should say, for a single music track was really, if it was a 2-minute track, we're really talking about more like 10 minutes of music. So on the contract, there was, I think, 35 minutes, which is less than Until Dawn, but it was like deeper. It was more granular. So it ended up being about, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times that total, like what could be done with the tracks. And then Barney, I know, is extrapolating it out even more. Until Dawn, I think, ultimately had, it was something ridiculous, like 17 hours of linear music from all the bits and pieces of the 2 or 3 hours that I wrote. And this is the same way. It's hard to quantify it, because, and it's really hard when you have to make a soundtrack, because I'm going back and I'm looking, it's like, oh my gosh, you see these 40 stems and really like 5 need to play at once. Otherwise it starts getting really cacophonous. So I could literally take a 2-minute piece and stretch it out to 10 or 12 minutes without it seeming like the same piece at all. It would just keep evolving and moving. And yeah, it's tricky. I wish I could give you a more straightforward answer.
That's okay. I mean, maybe in a way it's better that you weren't keeping track.
Yeah, stuff like this, you know, it's always about how to make the game the best experience possible. And I tend to not really think too much about contracts or budgets or number of minutes or anything like that, to a fault, I would say. If I were younger, I'd be more shrewd and maybe I'd be a little more careful. But, you know, these are people that I've worked with forever and none of us are doing it to get rich. We're all paid well, we're compensated, and we're doing what we love, and that's amazing. But really, everyone's bottom line is, what's going to make the gameplay the best? Oh, you need 3 more different versions of these instruments that I played live? Sure, I'll do some more takes for you. No, it's not going to cost you anything extra. You know, it's all part of the package.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, you must have worked with him really, really closely, the audio director, because there's a track of Storm Is Coming that really sounds like it kind of grows out of the audio design. I mean, the way that cue builds, it's just in little hints and little flickers of things. And then the way the storm comes, it's just, it's really terrifying. And you mentioned, so that one must have been fun to put together, fun to think about, knowing how it was going to fit with the audio design of being on this ship.
Yes, that's another thing that's really tricky about these soundtracks is, you know, that was called, I think that was called Kidnappers 02 or something like that. And then, you know, 2 weeks before the game came out, I think the publisher actually named most of these tracks. Maybe half of my names stayed, but I had some really fun names like Thunderbolts and Lightning, very, very frightening. And, you know, I'm big on the puns and they wanted it to be serious. So that was fine. The description that I usually get before I start a cue is something written like on a Google sheet so I can always refer to it. But then we have a Skype for probably an hour and talk about where in the game this happens and everything that's going on, what's playing before it, what's playing after it, and how many kind of interactive elements need to happen. And for this one, it was actually pretty simple, and it was one of the first cues that I wrote after Of Storming Seas and Howling Winds. And it was, you know, I don't want to give too much of the game away, but everybody's asleep on the boat and these kidnappers come, and he showed me some artwork that showed, like, you know, people on the boat and this guy standing above them, and it's terrifying. It's even scarier than in your home, because you're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you can't even call the cops. It's like you're literally on the moon, practically. You're completely by yourself. So the idea of them sneaking onto the boat and very quietly kind of getting and then standing over everybody and sort of the desperation and fear that ensues after that was basically the point of that like three-minute track. And that's why it builds the way it builds. I was just picturing, you know, their boat coming up to the other boat and they're sneaking and getting out and crawling around, and it's quiet and brooding, but also kind of, you know, very like insistent, I think would be a good word.
Yeah. And ruthless too, because clearly they're pirates, and so you know, show no mercy. Well,
now you know why I felt so, you know, so sensitive about not writing bad pirate music.
Yeah, well, of course, it's probably pretty easy to write bad pirate music, but if you want to write good pirate music,
oh yeah,
you gotta work harder. So
yeah, writing bad music is like way too easy.
Well, I love how you use the strings in that, because there are a lot of like extended techniques. And again, I think that just kind of reinforces, it's a little bit disorienting. You don't really know as a character what's going on or what's going to happen next. And so did you use some of the samples that you had originally put together for Dead Space, or did you use live strings, or how did you get to that sound?
So I did an extensive amount of sampling for the first two Dead Space games, but those were, you know, under the auspices of EA, and I was recording, essentially, I was recording music for the games, even though it was just, you know, rink or, you know, some sort of a sound effect. So that, you know, had its place in Dead Space. But I learned so much about sampling and kind of extended techniques and things that I sort of became an addict, and any recording session I had after that, including the three sessions I did for Until Dawn, I always booked an extra day on my own dime and recorded more stuff. So it's like if I, you know, if I did like maybe two of these techniques for Dead Space that I really, really liked, I went back and later on just whenever I had these extra sessions, I'd do like 10 of them instead of two and maybe get a bunch of variations. So over time, I've built this, I'm not kidding, this huge library of extended effects that for brass and strings mostly. And I mean, I don't even remember what some of them are. I'll sit there and spend 5 minutes just looking at the computer going, well, I wonder what this is, and kind of twiddling some knobs and moving some keys and go, wow, that's really cool. I don't even remember doing it. But that's what all those string techniques that you hear, they're all sampled, but you know, I'm triggering them on the computer and performing them, so to speak. Same thing with the brass. But there's also a lot of percussion and like bowed things, especially that are live, that are me recording. You know, a lot of like out of tune dulcimers and some Mid-Eastern instruments and things that are sort of, you know, tuned a little too high and, you know, like really tense and, you know, that sound like maybe some extended string techniques. They sort of blur, and that was on purpose. You know, we didn't have time and we didn't have budget to do all of that granular stuff live. And that's one of the main reasons I've done all of my sampling over the years. It was the same thing with Tomb Raider. It was the same thing with Until Dawn. A lot of these scary games, Swamp Thing, that we'll talk about in a little bit. You know, it just makes sense. I guess I'm just sort of blessed and cursed with my last name, so I needed to make sure I had, you know, some virtual ammunition to back that up.
Well, you mentioned, you know, Bernard Herrmann being one of the influencers on your, you know, big ideas for this score, and I absolutely love those kind of psycho strings that come in toward the end of this cue too. I mean, and yet you don't overdo it. It's just there because it's makes like a great jump scare kind of.
Yeah, a little goes a long way with that stuff. And that was such a groundbreaking score when it came out. That whole movie, you know, they kill the heroine, mm-hmm. the star of the film, a third of the way through.
Yeah,
and you just can't. You can't make a movie like that now. And I feel like it's also hard to see that for the first time. Like, I couldn't even show it to my kids because they know about the shower scene and they know about the ending scene. And, you know, maybe they didn't know that Marion dies a third of the way through, but it just doesn't have the kind of impact now that it did back when it first came out. But yeah, I did extensive, you know, their players are just sitting there all day, and I got them to do it. It was on the regular strings and behind the bridge, which is just like chilling when they play really loud behind the bridge on those, like, it's like, oh, it's painful to listen to. And they're just sitting there, you know, with big smiles on their face. They're having so much fun recording this stuff because they never get to do it like that. They always have to, you know, play a little Mozart or something. It's fun to be able to, you know, get outside of your sandbox and do something different.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. With your, you know, 300-year-old Guarneri and just torture it a bit and something.
Yeah, I have dowels. I have these dowels that I made that I bring to all my sessions when I record stuff like this. Because, you know, some of their bows, I mean, they can be like $50,000 or $60,000 just for their bow. Actually, there was a violin player who's the assistant principal of the North Carolina Symphony here in town. I think his bow was $90,000.
Wow.
So it's no wonder if you're asking them to turn their bow around and use the wooden part and slap the strings and it says like forte or triple forte, they're going to go tap. they don't want to play that. But if you give them a wooden dowel, then it's literally like they're all kindergartners. And after every single cue, I'm saying, put, you can see what I'm doing. I'm putting my hands over my eyes like, oh my gosh. It's like, no, put the dowels down. We're not using the dowels yet. And everyone's like doing swords and they're tapping on everything they can get their hands on. And so when it comes time to do like Colegno and stuff, they're all over it because they're not using their $90,000 bows. It's important to consider the poor musicians and the investments they have in these instruments.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's so funny. I never thought of that. I would love to see some video of them having sword fights with their dowels.
Oh my gosh, the sessions were, I was shocked. I mean, I was a nervous wreck, especially for the Dead Space ones, because I had never done it before, and I couldn't find anybody who had done it on that, you know, 3 days worth of recordings, that kind of a scale. So I'm sort of like a basket case, and we're finishing takes, and they're ruining the ends of takes because everybody's laughing. And I don't mean like snickering. I mean, they're not snickering. They're like, because they're having so much fun and they're getting such a kick out of like trying to one up each other on doing something, you know, aleatoric and crazy. Because it just says like, you know, like brass players, it'll just say, play your loudest note as many times as you can. And, you know, they're all, I think it's the A flat. They're like, are you kidding me? It's the D. And then they're going, bwah! And they're just looking at each other and nudging each other. And, you know, it just turns into this, well, like I said before, it's like kindergartners again. They're getting to do all the wrong stuff. Basically, they've been trained their entire lives to never do,
yeah.
Which is a blast.
Yeah, I bet. Well, and then that's like two sides of the same coin, I guess, because the way that you end up using all of that stuff that they did while they were laughing and having fun, it turns into the most terrifying music there is. And so,
I know. Which is funny because, you know, for me, it's not scary because I've been doing it for so long. I'm completely desensitized from it. My brain's just analyzing it. And actually, even worse, I've built up such a tolerance that it just doesn't seem scary to me. So I have to do something else to put on top of it to make it even scarier. And I end up kind of one-upping myself, not on purpose, just because I'm like, well, that's not scary. It's just this one thing. I got to put 10 things on top of it. So it sort of ends up, you know, I guess the jump scares work because I'm bored and I think they need to be scarier.
Speaking of North Carolina and other scary stuff, this music for Swamp Thing, for DC Swamp Thing that you wrote, which is filmed, it was filmed in North Carolina. So, I mean,
yeah,
did that
yeah.
give
nice
you...
Nice segue. That's yeah, impressive.
Hey, that's what they pay me for, you know. So, did that feel, I mean, did you even notice that it was filmed in North Carolina and that did that help at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they filmed it in Wilmington. My wife grew up in Wilmington, so I've only watched the pilot with her, but literally, she's like, that's the so-and-so church. That's three blocks from my house. That's the blah, blah, blah school. I mean, she recognized everything. So it was very much like even the, you know, the swamp, quote-unquote. It's a river, but they call it the swamp, but the the river, I'll call it, you know, there's all these big houses and all this great land. And yeah, it's really a testament to the beauty of North Carolina, especially on the coast. And a lot of the actual swamp stuff, they built a huge interior set of the swamp so they could control it. But the external locations with houses and things, they just totally recognized. Of course.
Wow. Did that like freak you out at all? Because when I lived in Chicago and I'd see movies set in Chicago, it's a little bit distracting in a way.
Like Ferris Bueller?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so I didn't grow up in Wilmington, but I'd been there enough to recognize some of the places. And honestly, you know, I think she's used to it because it's such a busy place for filming, especially TV shows that she's used to. I mean, they filmed some TV show that she was watching as a kid at her grandfather's house, like when she was a kid. So she's sort of kind of used to that, like second Hollywood sort of thing. For me, I was too focused on needing to get the music finished to be, you know, influenced at all that it was filmed in Wilmington. Although I was thinking, like, man, they're like, I'm working on episode 3 and they're filming episode 6. A 2-hour drive to Wilmington, I could go to the set and like see everybody, and that would be so cool. But I didn't have time.
Wow.
Of course.
Yeah, too busy like doing the actual music for it. And so, what are some of the demands of writing music for TV that are different from writing for games? I mean, is the window of getting something finished a lot shorter?
So much shorter. Like it had been probably 15 years since I'd done any TV. When I did TV at the beginning, I was in Los Angeles and it was the mid-90s. Oh my gosh. No, make that 25 years. We're so old. Oh my gosh. Yeah, so it'd been 25 years. It was the mid-90s, and we were doing weekly episodes, and I was super busy working on stuff. I had 3 different shows that I was working on. We didn't have the technology that we do now, so it took a lot longer to do the music. And literally, I was finishing stuff and like running it to 3/4 tape, and there was a runner waiting to like go to the dub stage, and they were dubbing in like 30 minutes. It was ridiculously stressful. And unfortunately, none of that's really changed. It's just gotten, you know, even tighter because now everything's digital. So it can be changed at the last minute. And, you know, all these changes are expected to, you know, just get turned around in a heartbeat. And I mean, conforming to video changes, like, oh, you know, we only took 2 seconds out of this one scene. But, you know, that ripples across the next 5 minutes of music. So you've got to go and tighten things up. But yeah, it's the same. It's kind of the same thing, just on a much bigger scale. Weekly episodes. So the TV that I work with, the two shows I'm officially working on right now are Project Blue Book, which is on the History Channel, and Swamp Thing, which was last summer. But those are both very much like Hollywood film score style scores. It just happens to be on TV. Especially Swamp Thing. That was very big, like horror, action, sci-fi, drama. They wanted everything to seem like it was the next, you know, the next movie starring The Rock or something like that. Which is why they hired Brian Tyler to do it in the first place. I mean, he's got the sound, but he also has 10,000 other projects going on. So, you know, we just happened to have the same agent, and Brian thought I would be a good fit, given that it had a lot of horror stuff going on, and he knew that I was already sort of deep into TV. I think the minimum number of minutes for an episode was like 35.
Wow.
Of music.
Yeah.
So 35 minutes of music, and that needs to be done in about 6 days.
Wow. How do you organize your day then to get the amount of music that you need to have finished, you know, ready to ship and stuff? Because I'd be like flailing about, worrying about, you know, no ideas are coming and that kind of thing.
Well, I've never had that problem because I'm always too terrified that I'm going to get fired. So ideas are not a problem, especially when you're working to picture. I got to tell you, my mom always says, you wrote how many minutes? How do you come up with all those? How do you think of something new? And I was like, Mom, it's like anything else. It's like cooking. You think, I don't know how to cook anything. And then you learn how to cook, you know, chicken. But then you learn that there's like a way that the French cook chicken. And then there's a way that the Italians cook chicken. And then there's like this California American way of cooking chicken. And then you start combining them all. And there's like an infinite number of ways to cook chicken. To me, that's sort of how all this music stuff is, except you're not just in a vacuum of space trying to decide how to cook your chicken. You're watching, you know, in the case of Swamp Thing, you're watching a scene play out, and it needs to do certain stuff underneath all these pieces of action happening. Or in the case of Man and Medan, you know, I know that these kidnappers are sneaking onto the boat, and I've seen all the artwork. So it's more an overabundance of ideas than any problems with writer's block or anything like that. But that's always been my case, because honestly, I'm too terrified of not making the deadline. And I think Far Cry Primal, I think I was doing like 15, maybe 18, it was five, you know, about 18 minutes of music a week for like the last 6 or 8 weeks, because they had some extra music that needed to be done. And that was, you know, me up at 4 in the morning and in bed at 8 o'clock at night, working 5 days a week. And I was getting like 18 minutes finished. One episode had 42 minutes.
Wow.
Of Swamp Thing.
Wow.
But, you asked how I schedule it. Well, if you looked at my calendar, there were basically giant X's over like 10 days at a time that just said Swamp Thing. That's how I scheduled it. I mean, I would get up at 5 and I would work until 7. And for the first couple of episodes, I worked 7 days a week. And I was exhausted. Then I started working 6 days a week. I've always worked 5. Now, you know, some composers, they're like, I can only write at night, man. Like, that's, if I'm writing scary music, it has to be dark outside. Or like, I'm rock and roll, and I'm not making fun of anyone in particular. It's just, you know, people have told me this in the past. Man, how can you play guitar before noon? That's just like wrong, or whatever. I've always been 9 to 5. I'm just like, I get up and I work, and then I stop. And that sounds real simple, but that's real important. So I stop at dinner time and I have dinner with my family, and we like go out and do something, or we go for a walk, or we watch a show, or run around with the dogs, or go see the chickens. And then I go to bed at a decent hour, and I get up in the morning and I have breakfast, and then I go to work again. And that time off is what allows me to not have writer's block. I said I never had writer's block. I lied, because halfway through Swamp Thing, it was on a Saturday afternoon, and I realized that I'd rewritten the same like 30-second scene 3 times, because I'd play the scene, and I'd hear some music in my head, and I'd put it into the computer, and then I'd listen back, and, you know, like 30 minutes later, and I'd go, "That's stupid," and I'd delete it. And I'd play it again, and I'd do it again. I did it 3 times in a row, and I thought, usually it's just like getting it in the computer and sounding the way I wanted is the main challenge. And I thought, I'm working too much. I don't have enough time off. But the episode was due on Tuesday, and I still had like a day and a half of work to do. And literally, I was like, that's it. I can't take it anymore. And I shut everything down. I turned off the computers, and I didn't work the rest of the day. This is like 1 o'clock. Took all day Saturday off, took all day Sunday off, came in the morning, Monday morning, dreading starting that scene again. And I knew exactly what it needed immediately. And I nailed it in like 15 minutes, what I couldn't do in 3 hours on Saturday. So for me, it's about that rest and recovery and being able to come back and then knock it out. Some days I'd only do 5 minutes of music if it was like a lot of action chase. Most of the time I averaged about 9 minutes. Sometimes I'd do 12 or 13 if there was a lot of dialogue. You know, you're sort of, it's slower and there's less activity in the music. I think when I did 15 minutes one day, I felt like the king of the world. I was like, 15 minutes! I came downstairs and everybody was applauding me. And I was like, I just wrote a third of the show in one day!
Yeah, I forget who I was talking with, but he said writing exploration music for a game is a nice break from writing music for boss battles and stuff, because it gives you a chance to sort of catch your breath and just to kind of take a step back and stuff. And it must be the kind of the same when you're covering dialogue versus, yeah, a chase scene and that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. It's like you're flexing different muscles. And before you know it, you know, 4 minutes of music have gone by. And in the span that normally you would have maybe done 30 seconds if it was, you know, super action chase stuff. The trick with that in TV and film versus games is if the music's fast, it's because something on screen is happening quickly, which means that there's going to be a lot more hit points and places where the music needs to stop and change and turn and take a left turn and then go backwards and then build up and then get quiet. And then it's got to do that a lot more. So it's a lot more work granularly on your part for the music than a conversation scene. That's kind of the nice thing about combat music in games is I determine where the music does all that.
Yeah.
I still want it to sound like, you know, I want it to sound like when you're listening to Man of Medan, like the track you said, There's a Storm Coming, that I'm scoring that scene in my head. You know, like you could almost see a cinematic where the boat's pulling up and they're getting on and all this stuff is happening, where I had nothing but the kind of general idea of the story to make that work. But I think that's why I fell back into TV so natural, like, you know, a year and a half ago. That's kind of where my instincts began back in 25 years ago. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was curious about some of the sounds that you put in. There's one track in particular, Transitions in Life, that has some really interesting things going on.
Oh, yeah.
And that just made me wonder, you know, what have you got like lying around your studio that you like pick up and, and bang on and sample? And
so many things. Let me see if I can unplug here real quick. And I know this is audio only, we're recording, but I'll give you a quick, let's see what we have.
All right.
At the moment. Well, there's a, we got a bass guitar, and then if I open the door out here, we've got there's a hurdy-gurdy down there.
Oh, wow.
And then this is a Bode Psaltery. It sort of looks like a Star Destroyer from Star Wars.
Oh, sure. It's that
but
little
you,
medieval ship. Wow.
Exactly. Yep. A Bode Psaltery. And then, there's a cello. get out of the way of the cello. We've got some synthesizers over here and a drum machine. The good old contrabass, which I use like all the time. This is a bearded dragon. This thing right here. So this is a garbage can lid from a metal garbage can. And this is actually some leftover fencing when I made my first chicken coop like 10 years ago. And I've got it mic'd up. So I bow it with a bass bow, and it makes the most horrific sounds you've ever heard. There's a lot of that in Man of Medan.
Oh, wow.
A lot. And there's a water fountain back there, also a lot of that in Man of Medan. And then over there, we've got a bunch of guitar amps and stuff. There's some of that in Man of Medan. Sometimes I'll take some of that Bode stuff and just put it through the guitar amps, and it just kind of gives it an otherworldly sort of sound. And then there's all kinds of guitar pedals, and there's a whole other instrument room on the other side of the door that's got my dulcimers and tambour and all those bowed and struck strings I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a, you know, I'll set up for a project at the beginning, and Man of Medan was finished before I started Swamp Thing, but about half of the Man of Medan instruments stayed behind, and then I sort of augmented them with some other things for Swamp Thing. You mentioned Transitions in Life. So there's a character called a passing stranger who's featured in the comic, and he's sort of this kind of cosmic being that, you know, he exists as a person, but he kind of just floats around a little bit and just kind of appears and disappears when situations need him. So the idea was that the music needed to kind of sound that ethereal, floaty kind of thing. So there's some gamelan bells in there, and a lot of just like sustained string textures, which was some of my favorite things that I recorded when I was doing my own sampling, to get the sense of floatiness in space where something sounds a little off, but it doesn't sound necessarily scary, but it's not happy and it's not sad. It's just kind of this, I don't know how to describe it, but the way I would record it is I would have like all the violins just play any note on any string just really quietly, and then maybe get them to play it as a swell, and you get these, it sounds like a jazz chord. I mean, because your ear picks up like what you think is the root, and wait, there's a suspension right there, and you know they're playing, it's just like this cluster, but it's a really, really beautiful cluster. So I used a bunch of those. I think those and the gamelan bells, which were not tuned, you know, it's kind of that, it's tuned to their scale. Yeah. It's not a Western harmony. That was a big part of cues like that.
The whole effect is just, yeah, it's kind of ethereal. It's hard to pin down and it's really mysterious. And so it must be like having a big sandbox to play in with all of these sounds. And I would imagine once you've nailed it down, then it gets really fun because you've got this, the setup, and then you can just go and see what kind of noises they're going to make.
Yeah, I try, you know, I try really hard to step outside of myself and project back to my like 20-year-old self and say like, okay, just stop for a second and appreciate the fact that you're recording all these cool instruments and getting to do all this super fun music, even though you're feeling a lot of pressure because there's a deadline and you have to write this inordinate, just Herculean amount of music every day. Three or four times a day, I stop myself and try to get a little bit of perspective and think, this is fun. This is super cool. Okay, oh my gosh, back to work. You know, because it's like a sprint. It's like a 100-yard dash that lasts 12 hours every day. It's hard to explain. You know, most creative folks, even if you're working in games and you're doing something creative, it's not on the level of like material, like churning out the material with music, because with music you can do it as a single person. It's a blessing and a curse, I think. I mean, yes, you could write a script as a single person, and maybe you need to do, you know, so many number of pages a day. That might be something that's similar. But most folks, it's a team effort. You know, you're designing textures for walls, or you're working on movement of a certain character, and it's kind of all going together, and you have a general milestone that's in 6 weeks, and there's some crunch at the end. And with music, it's always like, the deadline's Thursday, it's Tuesday, and you need to write 22 minutes of music. So, and it's just you. There's nobody else to really team up with. Well, at least for me. I've always worked by myself, so people do like to partner up and have assistants and things, and that's totally fine. I would probably be doing more of that if I were in LA, but there's nobody around here. I'm out in the middle of the woods all by myself, kind of on purpose.
No one can hear you scream. And so.
Exactly, except my family. Daddy, are you okay? I'm fine.
Yeah, I imagine at this point they're pretty used to hearing really unearthly noises coming from behind the closed door. And
so. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, the door's never closed. That's the thing. The door is always open. So my wife, most of the time, we're just watching Project Blue Book right now. I got the first season on DVD, and she'll go, oh, I remember this cue. Oh, that's what was happening there. Because, you know, she heard that 60 seconds of music for like an hour and a half because she was just sitting in the bedroom down the hall. But yeah, most of the time it's my daughters, because they'll just sit and watch. They're like, oh, that's cool. What's going on? Like, who's that and what's she doing? And, you know, Project Blue Books takes place in the 50s. So their outfits are always like super cool. It's like, I love her outfit. That's so cute. And then we're watching it. She's like, I remember this scene. She's got that really cute, like, you know, bow in her hair. You know, everyone takes something different away from it.
Yeah. That's so cool. And in the midst of all of this terrifying music, you also got a chance to go back to the world of Quill, our favorite little mouse heroine, and write the music for The Twilight Garden. And it must have been so much fun to have a chance to write more music for her.
Now that was fun, and that was a joy, and I did not have to stop and tell myself that I should appreciate what was happening, because I was appreciating it the whole entire time. It was amazing. And it was just like the game, where there was no super stipulations or requirements or anything. You know, I talked with Polyarch, and we got the general idea of what the music needed to do, and I wrote a suite just like I did for this, what, 7 or 8 pieces that were on the original soundtrack. But this time I got to do kind of a little more of what I wanted to do in the first Moss that didn't really seem appropriate, and that was put a little bit of Celtic in there. Kristen did some whistles. Oh my gosh, I love stuff like that. So I almost was worried that it was a little too, like, on the nose when I was doing it, but Kristen said she really liked it, and then they loved it, so I was over the moon, because that whole suite was just so much fun to work on, to go back and, you know, play all the instruments again and get Kristen. She played, like, bassoon and bass clarinet and whistles and all kinds of fun stuff on it. That was... Oh, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and I love that it's this 8-minute suite, because it really has an arc to it. You know, it starts out in this sort of gentle, kind of mysterious, there's like a little Celesta kind of thing, because it's, you know, it's DLC, it's a different part. I mean, Quill is on her way, she thinks she's found a shortcut back to the castle, and instead she's in this really kind of otherworldly twilight garden, which is neat. And so having all the little bells and stuff, it's just really such a great fit with the look of the game and the feel and the adventure that Quill is going to have.
It was just so much fun. I love those kind of harmonies. And since I've become this harp player since the first Moss came out, I played a bunch of harp on Man of Medan as well. And I just got this little Celtic harp that you hold in your lap. And it's not the best one. You know, it's maybe a $400 or $500 harp. You can pay, you know, $3,000 for a good Celtic harp. So it sort of goes out of tune after about 60 seconds. So I'm constantly tuning it. And it takes me forever to go from like one scale to another. And I remember, I think it was just half a day just to do the harp parts for that opening bit of the suite. For this DLC for Moss, because like every three or four bars, I had a different cool, like kind of extended chord that the strings were playing. And it was a completely different scale on the harp. And I don't have pedals and things that modern concert harps do. So I just had to like go in and tune each note. And then one would be a little sharp or a little flat. But I think that's another part of it, that opening especially, that gives it that really floaty sense, is the harp's always glissing up and down on those scales that the strings are playing. And I guess you can do that in the computer, but I love the idea of, you know, I can play guitar, so harp's not that far off, especially when you can, you know, start and stop and try a couple of takes and things like that. It was just great, great fun. I think I spent like 3 or 4 days, you know, on those 8 minutes of music as opposed to, you know, doing 15 minutes in one day. I took my time with it, and it was just wonderful to be able to go back and do the themes again, to get Kristen playing other stuff. Yeah, I, hands down, probably one of my favorite games I've ever worked on. But I think it's because the music was so pleasing to write, because hopefully it's pleasing to listen to. You know, it wasn't scary or tense or, you know, it was more like fun.
Yeah, I mean, there are places where it is really intense when Quill is got a battle going on, but yeah, the melodies are great. It's great to hear those little themes that you've snuck back in again, and that little like Scottish snap thing that, you know, ba-da, ba, ba, ba.
Oh, I love the Scottish snap. Yes.
Yeah. So it's just, I could just tell. I mean, there's like a lot of joy in that, and it's just so great. So hopefully we'll get to hear more. I know you can't really say anything about that, but I know Quill has a huge, huge fan base. Two of whom are sitting right here.
I know.
So, yeah.
I know. I mean, I think that's saying something. If I'm sure you've probably listened to it as much as I have, but yeah, it just doesn't get old. It's I think that's also a testament to the players. Having Jeff and Kristen and Maluka singing the song was just incredible. Mm-hmm. It's always nice when there's other performers besides yourself. And this with this expansion too, every time Kristen sent me new stuff, it was just like Christmas Day, because I get to drop in the whistles that she worked on or the flutes and everything. And then I didn't even know she played bassoon, so the you hear the melody for the big toad. It's kind of like that da 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 da, and that's bassoon, and is it bassoon and like flute, I guess, and like in octaves.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just had a MIDI bassoon, and I think she texted like, "Where's the bassoon part?" or something, because I sent her the flute parts, and I said, "Do you play bassoon?" And she just sent me a picture of a bassoon, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, it's exactly the same as the flute part. Just play it an octave down," and she did. So I got live bassoon. So I wrote some other bassoon stuff for her too. Once the fairy appears and sort of challenges her to the battle. You know, there's some more major key battle stuff too, which was really great at the very beginning. There's kind of a whole tone scale thing going on, which was fun. I could sit here and talk in circles about Moss all day. It's just a lot of fun to go back to that universe. You know, and it's such a privilege to be a part of it, because there's such incredible craftsmen doing what they do. You know, everything has a point, and everything's very meticulously designed, and to be able to live in that world with them and contribute like that and write that kind of music that's emotional on its own as well. And then you put it with the gameplay, and I will still tear up under on some points of the game.
Yeah.
You know, when Quill's weak and she can't go on, and Moira's doing that incredible voiceover, and they bring in some of that music that I did, and it's just like, oh my gosh. I mean, this is like as impactful and poignant as any film or book that I've read. I love that. That's kind of the highest form of art, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk more about more music for Quill. But wow, Jason, it's just been so much fun to play catch up and and hear about what you've been doing for the last year. So thank you so much. It's really been a lot of
fun. 3 hours later. I know. Well, you know, we're going to blink and it's going to be GDC, and then I'll see you there, yes?
Oh, absolutely. So thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.